If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to Alonement. I'm Francesca Spector, a journalist, author, and host of this podcast. Each week, I interview people that I'm interested in, all about their time alone and what it means to them.
It isn't enough to say that you can know yourself by being alone, because there are ways of being alone that below the surface are actually ways of not being with yourself.
You can feel lonely in a room full of people, and you can feel so content completely on your own.
Whatever your age, life stage, or relationship status, we can all enjoy a bit of time by ourselves. And on this show, we discover wisdom and personal stories about how to do that. Because when alone time isn't lonely, it's alonement.
People who are able to feel seen and understood, feel enough within themselves when they're alone, are so capable of giving that to others.
A lot of the cultural discussion that we have tends to be about the adjustments that introverts need to make in order to thrive in our extroverted world. But I think it really goes both ways. I think that all of us need to learn to make adjustments, you know, to find a greater sense of balance.
There are certain rites of passage that take place after a major breakup. For some, it's a haircut or a big solo trip, or a regrettable rebound with someone the polar opposite of your ex. My guest this week, Alice Vincent, departed from the clichés. For her, it was growing plants. In her partly autobiographical books, Rootbound and more recently, Why Women Grow, Alice chronicles how she came to growing as a way to heal and regain a sense of control after a breakup in her late 20s. As her life has changed, Alice is now married with her first child. Gardening has remained a constant for her. In this episode, we discuss how Alice has navigated the changes of the past 7 years, how gardening has allowed her to maintain a version of independence throughout it, and why she never feels lonely while out in the garden. Later, Alice also shares her tips for beginning your gardening journey by yourself. Whether it's just growing herbs on a windowsill, using a balcony space, or joining a community garden. Before we get to the episode, I want to thank our season sponsor, Sensate. Have you always loved the idea of meditation, but never quite got on with the practice? Sensate, a palm-sized infrasonic stress and anti-anxiety device, is the friend that you need. I've been practicing things like breathwork and meditation for 2 years, but integrating this little device into my daily sessions, which syncs up your choice of relaxing soundscapes from the Companion app, has helped me discover a new kind of deep relaxation. There are lots of tracks to choose from, including nature sounds for stress relief and soothing sleep rhythms. Visit getsensate.com/alonement for 10% off your first device. I'll also pop that link in the show notes. I want to start off by asking you a really simple question. What does alone mean to you?
I mean, I think primarily the first thought that comes into my mind is one of being often, weirdly, in the house alone. which over the past year has changed massively. I used to live alone, and that was such an active practice for me because I grew up in a big family, and I'd say my greatest fear is probably loneliness. So living alone was this sort of amazing and quite scary in some ways existence to have, as well as being massively privileged. But in the past year, I've had a baby, so I'm like very rarely alone. I think I've been in the house without the baby once in the past 8 months. So and my husband is obviously around as well, but to be alone now is such a strange luxury, and I feel it, yes, in the house, but also if I'll go out in the evenings by myself, and like that notion of being a free and independent person is going on the tube, sitting on the bus, not sitting on the priority seats on the bus, not sitting where the buggy has to go, sitting where, like standing on the tube, roaming through London. Aloneness has taken on this totally new meaning, which is that nobody, I almost feel like I've got this whole other life secretly sleeping in a cot in a house that nobody knows about. And suddenly I'm this kind of newly exposed, vulnerable person that no one knows anything about. And I could go and do anything and be anywhere. But also at the same time, I've got this direct, very distinct tether to the baby back at the house. So right now, being alone is kind of taken on this weird new sheen. But before then, I suppose it was, a real sense of just being without company, which for me has always been something that I found quite challenging.
I'm really noticing your use of language there, strange luxury. And I think the interesting thing about alone time is it's so subjective. I mean, in the depths of loneliness, it holds almost this negative value. And then the best times of living alone or doing something like solo travel or whatever will celebrate alone time, it then becomes this wonderful thing. Do you think you would be able to describe it as a strange luxury if not for that, having had that experience of sort of going through and falling, I guess, falling in love with it while you were living alone and then bringing that experience into now?
Yeah, I think even when I didn't have a child and when I was sick, like this, as I'm sure you've explored so many times, there is such a distinct difference between loneliness and alone. And it's something that I do write about actually in Rootbound, which was my first book. And I went to Japan by myself for 2 weeks on this holiday that I'd booked with the person who dumped me, which triggered the entire book, which is all about heartbreak, I suppose. That trip to Japan was one of the greatest things I have ever done. But I nevertheless spent the first week so self-consciously alone, very much like I can do what I want. And I can be where I want to be, and I can be totally accountable for whatever I want. I don't have to think about anybody else. And yet I was so self-conscious of being like, I'm doing this by myself. Do you know what I mean? And I every year or so, it used to be more often, but every year or so, I will still take myself off for a solo trip somewhere. And that now that's like a night away in a hotel, whereas in previous years, it has been half a week off grid in a cabin by the sea in January, where you just don't see any other people at all. And I feel like I'm always pushing at the boundaries of solitude in this sort of minor, playful way, because it's something that I have to overcome. Like, it does not sit naturally with me. And that's not because I feel lonely so much as that I'm an extrovert and I really enjoy the company of other people. So it's not for me even necessarily a kind of relationship thing or a single person thing, but it is a luxury because I always indulge in it in that as a kind of practice. Like, I spend money and time on booking these trips away. And now it's a luxury because I'm just never by myself. But yeah, when I lived alone, I was very conscious of the privilege of that. And I was also quite conscious of the discomfort of it as well.
Yeah, which are two difficult things probably to hold at once. But I totally relate in terms of, I guess, being thrust into that situation. I am also an extrovert. I also wrote and came up with the concept of alonement after quite a significant breakup in my late 20s. It's all sounding like a big rite of passage at the moment, but it really was a special time. And I completely get what you, I get what you're saying about it sort of being that that luxury and that privilege. And you have to be aware of that, especially in a city like London, where it is so hard to live by yourself. And you know, getting to that stage is such a wonderful thing. But I think also perhaps maybe that the weight of that privilege can make you almost, I don't know, should yourself into, you know, I should like this, I should enjoy this sort of automatically. And it is a process. But just to, you know, to go back, because I think we were talking just before we came on air, I think the really interesting thing about your work is it your book, Root Bound and Why Women Grow, they're both partly sort of autobiographical memoir. And they do quite a range of, I guess, experiences, life stages that women tend to go through in their late 20s, 30s, the sort of, you know, the major breakup, the being single, the living alone for the first time, living with a partner. And then, of course, you know, the stage you are now, which is sort of living with your husband, having a child. For those who sort of aren't aware, Root Bound was about finding solace in growing and discovering sort of a balcony garden and the power of nature in the wake of a breakup in your late 20s. Could you tell me a bit more about this time and what you discovered, I suppose, about yourself and the wider world during it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was so, the events of Root Bound happened 7 years ago now. It is the story of a year, and that year was 2016, which is a pretty... It's funny, we look back at it from 2023 and it all looks very halcyon and pure. And at the time we thought it was the worst year going. But yes, I essentially on paper had a pretty good innings. Like, I had a cool job. I was a music journalist for a newspaper. I had a beautiful flat in Camberwell where I lived with my long-term partner. And on paper, it all looked so good. We went on like cool holidays. We're living that kind of millennial, mid-20s, like got it sorted, got the G-plan sideboard, like, you know, through little dinner parties, the whole thing. And in hindsight, I was actually really, really lonely. It's the one thing I realized now as 7 years on, that I was very lonely in that relationship. But what happened next, which might have informed what happened next, which is that I was convinced that this relationship was the real deal. One summer morning, I was just broken up with completely out of the blue. And that meant that I wasn't able to live in the place we shared. And it sent me into a bit of a tailspin. As you say, it's a rite of passage. It's your classic late 20s Saturn return. But I questioned everything. I questioned the job that wasn't making me very happy. I questioned the things that I valued in life, which I don't think were making me very happy. The relationship was obviously completely blown out of question entirely. And I suppose I'd spent a long time trying to achieve what I thought I should. So interesting that you use should as a verb. But yes, like, question what I thought I was meant to have to make me happy, and none of it did. And after the kind of typical summer of excess and bacchanalia and heartbreak and survival, indulged in a nascent hobby, which was growing things. And at the time, it wasn't really talked about, and it wasn't really a cool, acceptable thing to do as a sort of 20-something person, was garden. But I found like a community garden, and I researched how other people in history had gone to ground in times of upheaval and found solace. And this is what was happening to me. And I suppose to answer your question, what I discovered was that, number one, whatever is happening in your tiny human life, the outside world or nature, if you want to call it that, continues regardless. The seasons continue, the plants go through their natural processes, things grow, things die, things return. That was a very, very heartening notion, because it made me realize that the world was a lot bigger than me, that my human concerns were quite small, and that I was part of a huge magical world that was right on my doorstep that I'd never really considered before. And that was really, really heartening. And I also happened to fall in love at the time with the person who's now feeding the baby Weetabix upstairs in the house, which helped. But I do think it was a time of finding what was important to me and mostly embracing uncertainty, because to grow is to constantly take a tiny punt on something you don't have control over. And I had been so determined to control aspects of my life that when everything fell apart out of my control, I didn't know what to do. But in engaging with the outside world, I was able to realize that there's a real freedom in that.
I completely understand it was a hobby that you connected with, but actually breaking down what is behind these urges, because I think these things ostensibly can seem quite arbitrary, where we pick up what we pick up. I was reading Monica Heisey's very popular, really good actually, and she talks about the sort of post-breakup urge to take up like a billion hobbies. It's very funny. She gets into like axe throwing and pottery, and it's so funny because whenever I hear someone's going to a pottery class now, I'm like, yeah, you're following that trajectory, aren't you? Think about gardening of any kind, and you talk about this in your books, it is by nature quite solitary and yet not lonely. There's a line in Why Women Grow where you say that you rarely feel lonely in the garden, but you always garden alone. What is it about nature or this particular activity that stops you from feeling lonely when you're doing it?
I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah, it was fascinating to me because Why Women Grow, you know, you said, oh, you want to understand these urges. Why Women Grow was that, or that's what I thought I was doing with that book. I thought I was trying to navigate the why, like, why do I like gardening so much? Why does anyone like gardening so much? It was actually a bit deeper than that. Some more stuff was going on, but ultimately that's where I came from, a starting point. And one of the things I wanted to explore in that book was this notion of sisterhood. I really wanted to find a group of women who garden together. And now the book is out, I meet so many women who are like, we garden as friends. I'm like, where are you when I was writing this? It was actually very, very difficult. And the only people I found who gardened together were Ali Smith and her wife, Sarah Wood, who have a very, very beautiful and extremely long relationship of gardening together. As long as they've been together over 20 years and they've been gardening ever since they kind of got together. And that's really a wonderful thing to witness. But I interviewed 45 women for Why Women Grow, and they were the only two who gardened together. Every single other woman gardened alone. And I thought that was so interesting because I garden alone. And I think it's actually about making space. And it's that so often women do not have space, even if they are fortunate enough to have access to land and a home to live in and everything else. We have to share our space constantly. You know, if you have children, you are clambered over, or you're sharing your body physically with your children. You know, if you don't, then you're probably looking after a home of someone you cohabit with, especially if you're in a heteronormative relationship. Beyond that, women are endlessly told to take up less space in society. We're told we have to be smaller, we have to be quieter, we have to inhabit smaller things than what men have. We're not allowed in the upper echelons of society as easily. But in the garden, we can make our own space. And I think that's a really powerful thing to do by yourself as a woman. And I think that's why we like doing it alone. I have been trying to get my bulbs into my garden. The difficulty of getting them in is because I need 2 or 3 hours to myself in which to do it. That's not a very easy thing to have at the moment. But I know that when I do, it will be a really empowering, exciting, visceral act, because it is a time when I can be alone just with me and the earth. And it doesn't feel lonely because there is the bird song, or because I'm doing an intentional act that is just for me. And I think that's the difference. And that's always been the case with my understanding of loneliness, that when I am doing a thing that I want to do by myself, it's actually fantastic. When I'm bored by myself, it's miserable. There's a difference there.
Do you feel like you're in flow as well when you're doing
Yes. Yeah, totally. I lose track of time endlessly. I'll be like, oh, I'll just pop out and do this 5-minute job. And before I had the baby, if we had a free Saturday, I'd be like, oh, I'll just go out to the garden for a bit. Or I'd get up early and go out to the garden. And then like the next thing I know, like, my husband emerged with a cup of tea, or he'd been rapping on the window to say, come and eat some lunch, because hours would have passed and I just had... I have quite a busy mind, and it's basically the only place where my brain naturally stills without me having to meditate or do anything intentional, because there's gardening is one of those things whereby you have to concentrate on the act in turn to a certain extent, but it's not so demanding that you have to focus all your attention on it, if that makes sense. So you do end up in this fantastic flow state. Flow is a great word for it.
Yeah, it's interesting you use the term sort of meditation. I guess what I quite like is that I think we're sort of broadening out what meditation can be. I guess under some definitions, they say, you know, it's a meditative act. Therefore, that's a kind of meditation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not enough of a meditation expert to espouse on that, really. But I have always found it very mindful and, yeah, meditative. Without being an expert in meditation. I'm sure if I became one, then I'd have some other opinions on it. But for me, it is a quietening act, which I relish greatly.
Yeah, and you also, I find it so interesting when you're talking about the notion of making that space. I keep thinking it's like a garden of one's own, a room of one's own. It's, you know, it's coming back to that female trope. And it's always quite a modest ask, right? Like a room of one's own, the Virginia Woolf essay. I always think men throughout history have built these gigantic castles.
Yeah. Yes, that is true. Yeah. I mean, she asked for, a room of one's own and £500 a year, which was in 1928. And she has been criticized for the kind of privilege of that. But at the same time, you're right. Like, we're not building giant phallic towers into the sky, are we? We're not building like grand designs, glass boxes. We want a space. Yeah, I'm coming to you from my hut of one's own, which I built in the wake of the baby emerging because he now sleeps in what used to be my office. And I didn't have that space to work, to write, broadcast, to, scream silently into a pillow, whatever. Space is so important. It's a deeply politicized thing. But yeah, it's massively important.
Yeah, it's harder to find in smaller homes, but you've sort of adapted. I enjoy how you seem to have picked quite gardening averse partners as well.
Yeah.
I know it's because, yes. You know, in Rootbound, you know, sort of even initially, even before your breakup, I think you were growing plants and things on the balcony in the home that you shared with your ex-boyfriend.
Oh yeah, he didn't give a shit, no. And then, yeah. My husband isn't, the funny thing that has happened is like, we have recreated the garden. I mean, I re-landscaped and redesigned the garden this year and we made it into a space that he could enjoy, which is that there wasn't really anywhere to sit previously. There was a lot of, I basically just put flowers everywhere and I've now created a space for us to sit. And actually, he will now come into the garden and use the garden. And it's very, very nice. I managed to have a knack of not finding life partners who garden. but maybe that is intentional. I don't know. I have no qualms with doing it by myself whatsoever.
It's lovely. And I don't know. I mean, you know, I imagine it's something kind of.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Kids get into at some point, but
so I'm not that asked whether he does or not.
No.
I'm like, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Well, annoyingly, and maybe this won't play to your advantage, I think modeling behavior is so much more compelling than telling your child to do something. So sadly. either your son will be sort of watching you from the glass, behind the glass, and thinking, right, I'm going to stay in with dad. This does not look appealing. It's British weather, or it might backfire for you.
It might come out. Yeah, we'll see. I will take him out. I do take him out in the garden, especially when it was warmer. He always chills out so much. And when he was small enough not to be fully mobile, he's always been really kind of almost annoyingly active. He's not a baby that sits still ever. But when he was, for a brief, glorious moment when he was, I could leave him outside and garden around him, which was so good. For the 28 seconds that lasted. Yeah.
I have a couple of friends who've become parents recently, and they will talk about these different stages. There's the sort of like silent, immobile baby stage.
Yeah, the happy potato stage. It's
the
great.
The happy potato stage, is that what people
call it? Really, I don't know. It's what I call it. It's fantastic. And I did not relish it enough at the time.
Appropriately plant-based.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like I've been on a sort of whirlwind of sort of going back through the last 7 years of your life, just through researching this podcast. Obviously, you've been living it, so that's probably even more more of a stretch. But you were really honest as well in your work, and I really like that you talk about the ambivalence of all these different stages. Even your sort of, you know, the initial stage with which you start Rootbound, you say, you know, I had this wonderful job, this great partner, this beautiful sort of millennial dream home, and it was still difficult. And one particular thing, and I guess a difficulty that you know, perhaps some of this you know, this podcast demographic might be well familiar with, is the difficulty of sharing a space with someone after you've had the experience of your own home. And you do talk about the ambivalence of how wonderful it was moving in with your now husband Matt, and how wonderful it was to be building a life together, but also that I don't know, the poignance, I guess, of saying goodbye to independence. Is that something that you still sort of experience, and what ways did you find to navigate that shift?
It's still something I think about. Like, would I want to go and live again by myself right now? No. Do I pine for that era of my life? Yes, undeniably. There's something, and I'm fairly sure if you asked Matt, he'd say the same thing. Like, there is something kind of wonderful about marching to the beat of your own drum. You know, you do give up something when you move in with someone as much as you gain something. And for me, it was very, very loaded, because the last time that I'd moved in with someone, like, it all ended in tears. So I sort of got over it by that point, because we'd sort of decided to get married and made a few other commitments. And I suppose I'd grown up a bit and got over some things. But like, I think that's why I like the hut so much, because it's like my own little space. But yes, how do you navigate it? God, that's a big question. I'm quite lucky in that I get kind of free rein over the interior design of where we live. And so I've really enjoyed making a home that speaks to my aesthetic whims and desires, which is nice. But also, it is an endless compromise, and we are two people who actually give each other quite a lot of space, almost to the point of frequently not seeing each other quite enough. We live quite independent lives, and when you do have a kid and you've got to choose who stays in and who goes out, that becomes even more pronounced. But I think that helps. I do think we're not the kind of people to sit around and do everything together, or sit on the sofa and watch telly together every night. It's not really how we operate. And I think that makes it a lot easier. And I quite like that. But yeah, it's tricky. And I think the heteronormative lie is so strong. We're sold this notion that if, like, you find someone to fall in love with and you fall in love with them and then you decide to be with them in a long-term capacity and you move in together, you will be happy. And that is not always the case. Some of the loneliest I've ever felt has been in relationships. And I think we just tell people that people who are single are lonely and people who are not. And it's total bullshit, because sometimes the constraints of a weird world that two people build around each other can be very, very stifling. And that has to be constantly navigated. I'm constantly kind of questioning and checking it in, like, To me, a relationship is a living thing that needs balancing and feeding and tending and enjoying on a daily basis. Like, it, you have to, otherwise you suffocate.
I love how plant metaphors sort of sneak into what I'm saying.
Yes. Get the plant feed on the relationship. Yeah.
No, not to take away from what you just said, because I think that's such a valuable perspective. And in a way, I think perhaps, I don't know, I don't know if it's better to believe in the myth or if it's better to be forewarned. I think it's probably, you know, it would probably put a lot of dating apps out of business if we realized that all of our problems, all of our sort of essential human loneliness wasn't cured by that.
Yeah. Or rather, I think you've got to be assertive. I think that's why people, when people meet when they're a bit older, whether that's in their 30s or their 40s or even older, sometimes really, you know, relationships either move very quickly or they seem to be, or they seem to settle very quickly. And I think that's because people have sorted their own shit out, and they've also, to a certain extent, and they've also understood what it is to be without a person. So they can be more consciously making decisions with a person. I think of the relationships I had when I was in my teens, even when I was in my 20s, and the urgency to do quite grown-up things baffles me. Absolutely baffles me. I honestly feel like I kind of sleptwalked into it, because I don't, it's interesting you mentioned ambivalence. I don't think I ever really desired any of that. I never desired living in a home with someone. I never really desired marriage. It took me a really long time to navigate whether I wanted a child or not. And I think it's the construct of the world in which we live that, you know, you just do the next step. And if you don't have enough experience or wisdom or courage, you don't question it. And that's how people end up in situations where you sort of wake up at 35 and be like, what is happening?
How did you come around to doing it on your own terms? What sold it to you?
Well, the giant aforementioned breakup helped. I took a really long time to settle. I started seeing someone quite quickly after my breakup, but it took me months and months to settle into something remotely looking like commitment. And I just was fortunate that I'd met someone who was very patient. But that, yeah, a lot of it, it took a long time. Matt and I lived apart for like 4.5 years before we lived together. So we just really, really took a long time over everything. We're the last in most of our social groups to have children. Child, we were the last kind of to get married. We took a long time over things.
And that time that you spent almost, I don't know, kind of coming to the idea a little bit more slowly, a little bit more gently, that time has paid off. That's helping you now.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it enabled me to, I mean, no one knows what's going to happen, obviously, but it enabled both of us, I think, to pursue the things that interest us as individuals. So I wrote best part of 2-3 books during that time. I did various things for my career. We went on some good holidays. We had a lot of good parties. Like, you know, it's not like any of those things stop once you get into a committed relationship. But I think we operated in a way that wasn't that immediate, like, forward rush into move into a flat together and do this and do that and do that, which, you know, it is a heady mixture of privilege and stubbornness, I think, as to why that didn't happen.
Yeah. But you sort of thrived together. And I think that that's a really nice thing to be said for a relationship, you know, especially that, you know, you were able to write your books at this time. And then you were able to be like, okay, I've written these books. Let's go into, you know, sort of starting a family.
Yeah, a little bit. As much as you can plan these things. Yeah.
Yeah. As much as, yeah, I think it's definitely, you know, worth saying, of course.
Yeah. And also, I have been like writing ever since the baby turned up, pretty much. So, like, it is not advisable or easy, but I certainly, part of the reasons why I needed to navigate the child question was because I needed to work out if I could do it alongside my creative work.
You were describing the space that you're in right now. Would you say your cabin?
It's a hut.
It's a cabin, hut. Your hut.
Shed, wooden structure in the garden. Yeah. Yeah.
And was that there? Was that built?
I built that after when Corin was 3 weeks old. Yeah. Not personally, but it went up as he emerged, pretty much. Which again was not planned, but it's how it happened. And it's been a fun metaphor, actually. But I'm very grateful for it. I do really like being in it.
And what makes it your space?
It's got lots of books in here, and it is away from the house. It has vintage Turkish silk rug, which, you know, what makes it like my space is that it is very similar in vibe and decoration to the flat where I lived in by myself, which my friends knew as Treehouse. In that, like, I look out a window and I can just see greenery. It's made out of wood. It has like the same wall color and the same furnishings that my old flat had. It's like a micro, teeny tiny version of the flat that I used to have. And I think that's something subconscious going on there. But yeah, it reminds me of where I lived when I was by myself. And it's a place that's dedicated purely to work, which sounds quite joyless, but it's dedicated to writing, which is one of my favorite things to do.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the boundaries really blur between work and, you know, creativity or whatever, you know, kind of leisure when it's writing that's your work. So I don't think that sounds joyless at all. But, you know, when I started this podcast, I really went into it thinking I want to make alone time, solitude, aspirational. And I think that we still lack a certain amount of representation in terms of people and even imagery. You know, it's rare that you'll see, you know, someone's, you know, place for one, someone's sort of hut in the end of their garden as the part of their home that they want to be sort of, you know, flaunting or, you know, putting on interior sites or whatever. But actually that I maybe I'm just, you know, speaking quite personally here, but I think, you know, listeners to this show who've had the luxury of either living alone or that, you know, that independence and then trying to navigate a changing life stage, I think that there really is an aspiration, a sort of, I don't know, almost a version of having it all, of having that space.
I really admire, like, not even admire sounds a bit patronizing, but when I kind of telescope out and look at what the future of my life might be, I can very much imagine myself as being happily alone in some capacity. If my life was totally different, I can imagine being happily alone. And I have a number of friends who are that, or who have chosen that, or I know people who exist in that way. And I think women especially are really good at it. And I think partly because we've had to suffer what it is to be partnered and pulling up like the brunt of that mental and emotional labor, and often physical domestic labor as well. And I can definitely see that as a life that I am yet to live.
Thank you for saying that. Do you think it almost gives you, I don't know, I guess a different vantage point within a marriage as well? Because I think that there's that difference between needing someone and wanting someone, you know, sort of maybe actively making that choice every day to be in a partnership.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, don't get me wrong, there are definitely times when I can be exceptionally needy in a relationship. I think everyone can. But I think of the things that we need of each other in the relationship we have formed, at least, constant company is not one of those things. And that is how we've learned to operate. So wrong or right, that's how it works for us.
it appeals, and I'm sure for a lot of people that would appeal as a sort of relationship style. I wanted to ask you this question just as a sort of slight digression, but I wanted to get your practical tips for people who live alone or sort of live in an independent way with flatmates and want to start a growing journey, because yours began on a balcony. I'm currently growing some parsley on my windowsill. That's my first foray.
Herbs are how I started as well. In fact, you know what, the one thing in my garden is really lacking at the moment is herbs. We need to sort that out. There's two ways to go about it. One, make a garden out of whatever outside space you have. So if that is a window box, if that is a balcony, if that is a shared yard, whatever that is, make a garden of it, in the sense of like, know how the light comes in. Maybe you have a shadowy kind of bit near, you know, like a light well beneath some steps down to a basement flat. Then grow a load of ferns. It'll be absolutely beautiful. Maybe you have a very exposed balcony. Grow a load of Mediterranean plants. You know, work to what your conditions are. So you know if it gets a lot of light or if it gets a lot of rain or if it gets a lot of shade. Kind of know your limitations to a certain extent, because then it can be actually very freeing. I started off as a container gardener. I've been a container gardener for longer than I've been a kind of land gardener. And you can grow all sorts in containers. It's very, very good way to start. So you get a big container, fill it with what you want, whether that's herbs, whether that's smaller vegetables and fruit, whether that's flowers. Have a go. Accept that you'll probably kill things, but you'll learn from killing them. Beyond that, there is, depending on where you are, there will be places where you can communally garden. So maybe that's helping someone out on allotment. Maybe it's going to community gardens. If you're based in a city, you'll probably walk past a community garden most weeks and not even know. They are everywhere. They really are. And that was so life-saving for me in the root-bound era. I volunteered at a community garden, and the relief and the satisfaction and the raw energy of kind of throwing my body into this big expanse of land and, like, you know, doing lots of repetitive tasks over and over and over was, like, very energizing for me. And there's a lot of people who want hands. So, you know, if you are someone who is an extrovert, who doesn't maybe have that direct company in your life, community gardening is fantastic. So you get to talk to people all the time, or you get to help someone out on their allotment. Plus you get to go home with, like, organic produce. Like, it's amazing. So yeah, those would be my tips. But just give it a go and grow what makes you happy, not what you think you should do. It's the same as anything you do in life. Do it because it makes you happy. Don't do it because you think you should.
As long as you're not trying to grow a Mediterranean plant in a shady...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then, you know, that's the first rule. Grow what will work in that space. And I love shade planting. Actually, when I lived alone, my balcony was very shady, and I still think it's the best garden I've ever made. It was beautiful. It's all like ferns and woodland plants and foxgloves. And yeah, it's amazing.
You know, you're shaming me here. I have I have a small balcony, and I don't know what's stopping me. Probably just some sort of mental barrier.
When the time is right, you'll get out there.
When the time is right, yeah. I just need, I haven't had one for a while. I just need like a major breakup just to sort of spur me
into
action.
Just really... Yeah.
That's so useful.
Very galvanizing activity, yeah.
Just to come to your latest book, in Why Women Grow, it opens with the image of a tarot reader drawing several cards for you. And one of them is a hermit card, which sort of tells you that you need to take some time by yourself. How did that prediction then play out?
That was the time that I went up to like an off-grid hut on the Northumberland coast in January. I like released the book and then vanished. I've got this habit of whenever I release a book, I sort of vanish, because it's quite noisy. And this time around with Why Women Grow, I didn't vanish, but I did kind of immediately have a baby. But that was a vanishing of its own, I suppose. Yeah, I went off grid for a few days. And I love Northumberland. I studied in Newcastle, and I love that part of the country. It's just these massive beaches, and they're deserted. Huge skies, sort of strange, mythic folklore runs very deep there. And... yeah, I just kind of hired a car and drove around and went for walks. And the days were very short, right? Because you're up north and it was January. So I'd sort of sit in bed in this cabin and eat poached eggs and watch the sunrise over the sea. And then I'd go for a bit of a walk, and then I'd come home, and then I'd just read and go to bed really early, switch my phone off. Yeah, it was... I mean, I make it sound really romanticized now, but it was a really galvanizing time. And it's something that I need to build back into my life, I think. But I think I am going away in January for a night. I finished Rootbound in a little pink fisherman's hut on Dungeness for 3 days. And that was great. I really like very kind of deserted, barren landscapes when I do it. More of that to come, I hope.
Oh, I think it's lovely. I think you can then, it is, as you're saying, it's like it's in a smaller way right now because you have just had a baby. But you can bring that solitude in sort of little and large ways. And I like that you're still bringing those rituals in and just adapting them a bit. So my last question, I want to ask, what is your sort of ultimate alone time right now, or what I call alonement, when time alone is fulfilling, restorative, or just purely very joyful at the moment?
I think in all honesty, it would be gardening if I could. And that will come in time. It's first thing in the morning writing. You know, we're talking early in the morning. And most days I will get out here around 7 o'clock and write. And it's on a really good day. I do it before I check my emails. I do it before I've replied to the WhatsApps. Like, it's my time. And at this time of year, I'm watching the sunrise behind you. It's absolutely beautiful. But you get this awakening of the day as your brain is waking up, and it sets me up. And it's not so much that it sets me up as that if I don't do it, I really feel it.
This was a really unique conversation, and I enjoyed it so much. As someone who's never really explored gardening beyond a couple of pot plants, it's opened up a special corner of the world for me. Perhaps it's done the same for you, if you weren't already a seasoned gardener. Thanks for listening. You can keep up with Alice's work via her wonderful Substack newsletter, which is on savor.substack.com, all about savoring the small things in life. While you can follow my Substack newsletter at francescaspector.substack.com to read all my latest writing. This season of Alonement was edited by Pineapple Audio Production.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.